everyone, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Well, recently, North Korea has been in the news again. First, they did a nuclear test, and then, of course, they were testing off rockets left, right, and center, which is something that they do periodically, especially when they want to draw attention to themselves. But this actually is an interesting one, because it's not about nuclear tests or missiles, but it's about the internet and North Korea. Now, the internet and North Korea are two words that usually don't go together. Now, North Korea does have its own intranet. Yes, its internal internet system. This past week, it was revealed that North Korea has, get this, 28, yes, around 28 websites. Not very much when you consider that some countries have, well, in fact, millions. So 28 is a very small number. Associate Professor Asha Rao is a security expert at the School of Science. Jonathan Green asked her, how did this all come about?
What they said is there is actually a project which goes around and scans continuously to see. So what was obtained was domain name servers. And so there's a project which goes and tries and scans and downloads anything they can find. And suddenly on the 19th, night of the 19th, they found these websites.
28. That's, yeah.
They're still trying to get more, but 28 is what they've got.
And have you had a look at some of these?
Yes. There's things like tourism websites. Mm-hmm. Where are they going? But not me. Not for me to question. But yeah, that was the one which was really surprising to me, was that there was a tourism website in there.
All of them best viewed on Netscape 3.2.
That's such right. And the language was so bad. You can't make out what they're saying. It's in English. Is it really in English?
In English. So they're perhaps intended for outside examination rather than internal.
I wonder about that. I don't know. Is it for people? Because I have heard that they try to get people back, you know, North Koreans who are outside, back into the country. Mm. Is it for them?
Is it so much an internet as an intranet in North Korea?
Possibly an intranet. Because, you know, when you say the internet, you should have thousands of sites. But of course, we're talking of North Korea.
I mean, it seems unimaginable that you could close yourself off from the world wide webs. Because, I mean, how does a country do that? How do you constrain that?
How would you do that? I think it's basically one is maybe not really have internet access to start with. So if very few people have internet access, then it's very hard for people to actually get access.
Now, I guess satellites, dishes and so on would be fairly conspicuous.
That's right.
Does this answer some questions about the you know, we worry a lot about cybersecurity and so forth, and North Korea would be potentially a place that might cyber attack the...
They were the ones who were accused of doing the Sony attack. You know, after that film.
So this might suggest that their capacity is not as developed as we might think.
Remember, this may be. So there are people who are wondering whether this is on purpose. They're trying to, I don't know, entice people to come in.
Give us a false sense of security.
That's right. But because they are well known for being nation state hackers.
Do they have a sort of a formal policy position on the internet in North Korea?
Not as far as I know. I'm not a North Korean.
these 28 sites, let's count them. Most have been taken down now, is that right?
Yes, that is the thing we're assuming that they've been taken down.
They've just disappeared?
They've just disappeared. Somebody has. I remember maybe they were trying to attract people to come in so they could then do something. I don't know. I wonder.
It's a curious thing.
It is a very curious thing.
So it was GitHub is where the dump occurred.
The dump occurs. And so you have to remember, one of the things about domain name servers or DNSs is that's the first thing that people look for when they want to do a hack. Mm-hmm. So getting that means you now know that these websites are open, are alive, and then you try and attack them.
So somebody was trying to potentially have a crack at the North Korean internet rather than the reverse.
Yeah, that's right. Possible.
And there was a lot of discussion about this, clearly. And
yes, there's a huge amount of discussion whether, you know, and people are, of course, having a laugh saying, oh, have you seen all 28 of them? And, you know, we'd like to know if there are more. What does it contain? Reading it is very difficult because of the English, you know. for normal people, but people are wondering whether it is on purpose, whether they want us to see this. That is why they've put it up.
Well, they are cunning.
They are cunning, very sure.
I'm trying to imagine a world in which there are 28 sites on the internet, and I'm failing at that. Right. It's a simpler time, perhaps.
That's right. Back in, I don't know, the early 1990s, when we had Netscape 1.0 or something.
the golden years of the
That's
internet.
That's right, yes. Where you had to wait for things to load.
Are people constantly, you know, keeping an eye on evidence of sort of online activity in places like North Korea?
Absolutely.
Is it capable of being observed easily?
Absolutely. Whether it is capable of being observed, not too sure. If it all depends on, you know, what the Western world thinks it's capable of and what it is capable of. So if it is as capable as we think, as the Western world thinks it is, then we're not going to be very easily able to get stuff. So, of course, there's going to be not only the, you know, the secret service of different countries trying to continuously ping them and try to get information.
It seems inconceivable that things can be quite that primitive there. I mean, your idea that this could be a ruse
sounds plausible. Really, it's really, you know, that they would not be sitting in the position that they are and be so primitive.
Jonathan Green, speaking with Asha Rao, a cybersecurity expert at the School of Science at RMIT, about the leak that happened that actually shared all the names and addresses of all 28 websites from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Try to say that 5 times fast. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Category 105, it is speeded to 22 journals.
Speed 220, Category 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Now, what makes a distinctly Indonesian novel? And have Indonesian writers have had less freedom over the past year? Well, actually, that seems to be the case. Elsa Vitiri Handahani and Maggie Chojakin discuss the future of literature after the political uprising in 1989. And there are different types of censorship and regulations that determine what is written about. They both spoke to Patricia Carvalhas.
In terms of distinct style, I think there's more variety nowadays. The younger writers especially, they're experimenting more with different styles. So there's not just one style. I think the interesting thing about the Indonesian literary scene right now is that there's so many options, which, you know, is nice because we didn't have that before.
When did this start to shift?
Probably in the mid-2000s, and especially closer to 2010, where more young writers are finding their voice and speaking out. A lot of young writers now read more. That's also good. So they have a breadth of references from around the world, and you know, they really want to take it to the next level. So that's the spirit of younger writers that I really envy, actually.
Yeah, I feel that before 98, it was, you know, it was authoritarian government, so there was a lot of censorship, so the writing didn't really flourish. Yeah. And after that, we have press freedom, we have suddenly it's okay to talk about taboo things that people couldn't talk about before. So after 2000, and I think then that a lot of variety of styles really grow.
So what was happening before 1998? You say obviously there was, we know that the Suharto regime was very oppressive, of course. Mm. But was it happening underground? Because often, if you look at history, a lot of creativity flourishes. Mm. Of course, it's very underground and very repressed, and it happens in a climate of fear, but it's happening.
I'm sure something was happening. I just wasn't in on it.
a lot of political things, like Seno Gumira, you know, you could, he's writing like political stories and you couldn't do in journalism. So then people like, writers like him turn towards fiction when it's like relatively freer. And critical theater.
Yeah. Mm. I was really isolated from that part because my parents didn't really support the idea of writing or reading.
Yeah, I think our generation, that's common. Yeah. Like my parents didn't support it either.
So, yeah.
What, because they didn't think it had an economic possibility? Was it based on that?
Well, that's one. But my parents' concern was that they were afraid that if I were to dabble in any of the, you know, because they know that I like to write, but they always warned me, like, you know, the government is watching you.
Yeah, you don't want to attract attention to yourself.
So.
Yeah, even it's, I feel it's so strong, like in my family even.
Yeah.
Like when we're given history assignments and then, you know, they would want to read it first and they want to censor certain things. And it's like, I was in junior high.
Yeah,
like,
your
no
assignments.
One's going to read that. And like my mother was like, you can't write about
this. Yeah, exactly.
Lisa, your novel really fleshes out the tension between hope and disappointment on a personal and a political level. Is this something often explored by artists and writers who come of age during the era you did?
Well, yeah, after the Reformasi, like I said, suddenly there are more freedom to talk about things you couldn't talk before. Writers like, you know, Ayu Tami and Jenar Mahesayu, they talk about sexuality a lot, and there's like political components in that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, but also what I think you did writing about 98 was very brave, because that's not something that a lot of people are talking about. I mean,
okay, so let's go to that. You're saying you called it brave.
Yeah.
Some time has passed from then. Of course, I remember that period very well as your closest neighbor. We certainly watched that period very intensely. It was a very difficult time. Has there been a reconciliation and an airing out of that time? Because you're giving me the very strong feeling that hasn't happened.
No. There hasn't been an official acknowledgement of especially the rapes that took place around the student protests in 98.
Yeah. Or really what happened at that time. Yeah.
Yeah, it's still dangerous to bring up, I think. There's been...
So do you still feel... Let's talk about the censorship currently going on, because I understand you... faced censorship of your book.
Yeah, there have been discussions about what happened in 98, like cultural events that were like attacked and forced to disband. So the most famous example is what happened in Ubud Festival last year, and a lot of sessions were cancelled because they were talking about the human rights violations in 65. But since then, there has been a string of more and more events and discussions and festivals and movie screenings and performances that were attacked or either by the police or like radical groups.
But your book launch was also censored at the Ubud Festival, wasn't it?
I was one of the session that was cancelled.
What was your reaction to that? Because you're writing about 1998, a whole period of repression, but you're experiencing
it's ironic, isn't it? I mean, when I wrote the book, I know there were parts of it that were going to be controversial because I talk about things that are still taboo to talk about, not just the political stuff. But
and what are those things that are still taboo to talk about?
Yeah, it's a book about like how we can be free, basically. So like these two characters, a man and a woman, they came of age during the student protest and they were part of it. And they thought, okay, we're going to get rid of this tyrannical government because we want to be free. But then like after it happened, like it's not enough. Like there's still like other things that are limiting, constraining us. There's still like our parents pushing us to a certain direction. There's still social pressures, especially if you're a woman. You're not free to just like be comfortable with your sexuality. Mm. Like there's a lot of repression around that. And then I also delve into like the more subtle things that can limit a person. It's like, can you just like, how much are you free to just reinvent yourself? Can you just choose to be a certain way? How much is your upbringing or your social situation is limiting you? How can you break free from all that? And where can you really find your freedom?
Yeah. So, and Maggie, are these themes that you explore as well? Are they difficult themes, do you find, to air in Indonesia?
Well, I'm on the other side, I think, in that I play it safe because I was taught to play it safe. So for me, the issues that I deal with is a sense of belonging because I took myself out of Indonesia consciously in 1999, thinking that this is not my country because I was told so many times that it's not my country. So I'm Chinese-Indonesian, and so...
Yeah, it's also a controversial topic.
Yeah, absolutely. Very prevalent issues. So I often had this feeling growing up.
Isn't the mayor of Jakarta Chinese?
No. So that's wonderful. But there's still that tension, right, about being Chinese Indonesian. It's better now. It's much better now. So that's why I came back in 2006, because I felt like I removed myself from my country. But the country had done nothing to me. It's some of the people in the country that did something to me. So I decided to come back.
You're in the drawing room, and I'm talking to two Indonesian writers, Maggie Tiojakan, she's an Indonesian writer and translator, and Eliza Vitri Handayani, who's the author of From Now On, Everything Will Be Different, and that's a novel set against the backdrop of the 1998 political upheaval in Indonesia. So you're both kind of, you're saying you're playing it safe, which yes. I love how you're just saying that I'm playing it safe. Do you think you're always going to play it safe?
I don't know. I think I'm trying to find new challenges, and by playing it safe, I'm saying things that, you know, expressing things that people often don't talk about, things like how we try to blend in any kind of situation because we feel like we're afraid of standing out. So that kind of thing, the minor details in everyday life for minorities. And that could, you know, not just minorities in terms of Chinese Indonesian, but all minorities around the world, how we try to not stand out. And that's what I try to bring up in my work.
The past couple of years seem to have seen the literary connections between Australia and Indonesia strengthening. Do you agree? Do you think there is a greater connection between our countries? And
I think so. I think there's a strong tie between the two countries, and it is getting stronger. But I also feel like it should have been stronger, much stronger. Mm. Just from the literary value, I think we should read each other more.
We should, which would of course mean that we learn more about each
yes,
other.
Yes, exactly.
And yeah. Perhaps then we'd have a better relationship.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's very important.
It's a step towards the right direction, but there needs to be a lot more.
Yeah, so that's why the cultural exchange program with RICE is, I think it's an incredible opportunity just to get to know each other.
It brings together Australian writers and Asian writers. Yeah. And talk about our writing and issues that we face.
So let me give you a scenario. For someone reading in English, and I largely read in English, coming to Indonesian fiction for the first time, what novel would you recommend for them to start with?
You can start with Eliza's.
It sounds like a good entry point.
Yeah. Seriously, 1998 is hardly ever talked about, and it's the most recent event that's, you know, closer
and
to...
And would you say it overshadows life in Indonesia still?
Yeah, of course, because no one talks about it until she did. Most of the, you know, documentation that we've seen has largely been, you know, documentaries and nonfiction, which is harder for people to relate to. But she put it in a novel form, which I think is easier, gives easier access for people to look at what happened. So I would start with that.
Thank you so much, Maggie. I like Intan Paramadita's horror feminist stories. And then I translated an Indonesian writer called Afianti Arman, and she rewrites, she writes poems, retelling of biblical stories of the women in the Bible. Mm. And that really touched me on a personal level. So that's two writers I like.
And Maggie, you're also a translator.
Yes.
I imagine this is very difficult to get right, because in a language like Bahasa, you're not just translating word for word, are you? There's something else you have to capture that's perhaps much less tangible.
Yeah, I like to look at the soul of the writing itself, because for me, translation is more than just about words. It's about the feel of the story. Not so much about, you know, whether a lot of translators fight over, oh, you should have used this word and that word.
And of course, I've got a friend who's a linguist and says, you know, there are certain words in certain indigenous languages here in Australia that you just cannot find in English.
Yeah, exactly.
It is not possible to find this word. It does not exist.
Yes.
And I always find that fascinating. Does that mean what, in English, this emotion doesn't exist, or this articulation of a feeling doesn't exist? Right. What does it mean about our cultural experiences?
Right. I think it's just context, really, because I think there's something about any story that has universal value. And I think that's what we need to look at when we look at a story and trying to translate that. What's the universal value? Mm. What can be passed on from that culture to the other culture that, frankly, wouldn't change the story so much, but it would just, you know, retain the feeling of the story.
speaking of translation and our previous topic, censorship, if I may, I'm running a Kickstarter campaign right now. I'm translating. Mm. We're publishing a banned literature in translation series. So we're going to publish short works by writers who have been censored or banned from around the world, from many countries, and translate to Indonesian and English. Yeah. And it's hosted by my translation organization. It's called InterSastra. So it's our way of standing up to all these attacks and forced cancellations of cultural events and the seizing of books that's recently, that's still happening in Indonesia. So it's our way to fight back. So if you want to support that, I'd appreciate it very much.
Do you feel like there's an increasing repression in Indonesia?
I mean, since last year, we didn't see this so much. Like, it was very free after 98, after the Reformasi. You get away with, like, you talk about 95, you talk about homosexuality. Like, the publishing industry boom, lots of small independent publishing, and just since last year, it's getting worrying. There's a lot of these things popping up.
There's a rise of extremism, I think, in the country at the moment.
Is there a rise in the Islamification of the country as well?
You could interpret it as that, yes. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah, it's really, political Islam is really strengthening, especially in the last years. And then the tendency is towards getting more and more conservative and discriminating towards, for example, the LGBT groups.
Yeah, there is a rise of extremism. It's just that I think it has more to do with political agenda, because I don't know anyone who's an extremist, whether it's in my circles or the as a journalist, the subjects that I interviewed, I don't see them.
People are tolerant.
Yeah, they're very tolerant. So it's a different picture of Indonesia that people see from the outside, and it's a different picture of Indonesia that people see from the inside.
And of course, the Jakarta Indonesia is different to many other parts of Indonesia.
Yeah.
Of course, it all is very fertile ground for fiction, though, isn't it?
Yeah,
very much so. Very much so.
There's no shortage of stories in
Indonesia.
No. Too much.
Too many stories.
That means you have plenty to write about.
We need several lifetimes. Yeah. So we need a time stopper device so we can write everything down.
I want to thank you both for coming. It's been such a great conversation.
Thank you for having us. It's wonderful.
To Aliza and Maggie, thank you so much.
Indonesian writers Aliza Vitrili Handani and Maggie Trojakin speaking to Patricia Carvalis about Indonesian writing, censorship, and freedom. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. When we come back, Glenn Hauser and Propagation. But first, this.
The British DX Club is one of the world's leading DX clubs, with hundreds of members both in the UK and around the globe. BDXE produce a comprehensive monthly magazine called Communication, covering all aspects of the DXing hobby. The BDXE Audio Circle is also available and is a monthly program of DX catches and general chat about radio. For more information, please write to the British DX Club, 10 Hemdean Hill, Caversham, Reading, RG4, 7SB in the United Kingdom, or visit the website at www.bdxc.org.uk. That's www.bdxc.org.uk.
All right, well, it's now time to turn our attention to Propagation, what's been happening and what we can expect. Here's our Propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith, RSGB Propagation says the autumnal equinox is an optimum time for north-south paths on HF. September can also offer some good opportunities for gray line propagation on the lower bands around sunrise. From IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through September 24th, normal at low and middle latitude bands, normal to fair at high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through September 24th, magnetic conditions quiet, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through September 25th, solar activity low or very low, with no significant sunspots expected. Geomagnetic activity mainly quiet. No solar radiation storms expected. From FK Yanda of the Czech Propagation Interest Group, the geomagnetic field will be quiet on September 23rd, 24th, October 4th to 7th, 11th and 12th. Mostly quiet on September 25th, October 3rd and 8th. Quiet to unsettled on September 26th and 27th, October 2nd, 9th and 10th. Active to disturbed September 28th to 30th. Quiet to active on October 1st. From SWPC in Boulder, geomagnetic field likely to reach G2 moderate geomagnetic storm levels on September 28th to 30th, with A and K indices of 35 and 6. Active conditions expected October 2nd to 5th at 18 or 15 and 4. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2, September 23rd to 25th and October 6th to 15th. Solar flux rising from 85 September 23rd to a peak of 100 on September 27th to 30th. Down to 80 by October 14th. William Hepburn's VHF UHF DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting between Mozambique and Madagascar September 23rd, between Korea and Japan September 26th, off the northwest coast of Africa and off the coast of Peru September 26th and 27th, off the California coast September 27th, and all week all around the Arabian Peninsula as far as India.
All right, thanks a lot, Glenn. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of the program. Our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. Just to let you know, we just started getting out the EQSLs for the special program that we had last week for the program 3, that is, of the Radio Netherlands archives. So you should be getting that very soon if you did send in a report for the broadcasts. That's all we have time for. Yes, that's all we have time for. Doing a double take. So until next time, friends, so long, take care. 73 and 88 to the ladies.